What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic or you are listening wherever podcasts are served, we certainly do appreciate it. We know you have a lot of choices out there. And this show couldn't happen without the help of our sponsors. Delete Me. If the tech giants make a fortune selling your personal information to all kinds of outlets for them to use as they please, Delete Me removes your personal information like your name, address, age, phone number, email address, photos of your home from leading data broker sites. Removing personal information from data broker websites reduces your online footprint and removes Google search results. These guys really understand opt-out and privacy policies, so you don't have to spend your time focusing on a bunch of legal jargon. Delete Me has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, NPR, and CNET. And with over 20 million personal listings removed, Delete Me is the most trusted and proven privacy solution available. So check them out by using the link in the description to see how they can help you take back your personal information. We're also brought to you by Fiverr. If you want to outsource some of your work or just need specialized help with a project that you are working on, you need to check out Fiverr. They have a network of thousands of freelance experts in business, design, programming and tech, digital marketing, music and audio, video animation, writing, translations, and so much more. If you need someone to build out a website or help you grow your current business with a digital marketing campaign, you can find thousands of people ready to get to work for you on your next project at a fixed price that you set at Fiverr. Your payment's only released to the freelancer once you're pleased and approved the work that you've received. If you have any questions, you can reach out to them 24/7. Just click the link in the description box and start putting this army of freelancers to work for you. And we are also brought to you by Cash Advance. We're living through a very strange time, filled with an unbelievable amount of uncertainty. We don't know what the world's going to look like a month from now, let alone, you know, a year from now. But if you find yourself in a financial emergency and in need of money right away, you at least with Cash Advance. You can submit your request online, receive an answer in minutes so that you'll know where you stand and what programs they have available for you. Their online service is entirely free and works to find potential lenders in their network. So just fill out the secure online form, see which option works best for you. Look, I hope that you don't need this service, but if you do during this crazy time that we're living in, at least you know you have another option with Cash Advance. Click the link in the description box to see what they have to offer. And of course, any support for our sponsors works to directly support our show as well. And I'm excited to get started with the show because we have Sean Atwood. And now, Sean, I've done his show a couple of times. He's been nice enough to join me on this show. If you are unfamiliar with him, well, you might want to check out the True Crime Podcast because it's blowing up. He has a great and interesting history that we're going to get into. He's the author of many books. Go to Amazon right now. You can buy Clinton Bush and the CIA conspiracies, from the boys on the tracks to Jeffrey Epstein. Sean Atwood, what's going on?
Craziness. Getting targeted for being a David Icke collaborator right
Ooh,
now.
Me too. Well, this is going to be on Iconic, so we could be cellmates in this digital gulag.
The Center for Countering Digital Hate has listed the David Icke collaborators, which must be removed from YouTube, because removing Icke alone is not enough. We are like his echo chambers. So they got Brian Rose as number one, myself as number two, this drug-dealing scumbag Atwood's got this YouTube channel pushing conspiracy theories. There's a whole paragraph on me in the report. And for weeks people have been saying you got to get all your content moved over to BitChute. And believe me, it is all doubly backed up right now.
Yeah, that's a shame. We cannot have the collaborators working with Mr. Icke. Well, you know, this isn't going to really work with you because you've been down this path and they can lean on you and try and scare you and intimidate you. But I would venture to say that there's nothing they can threaten you with that you haven't already been through yourself in your previous incarnation as an ecstasy trafficking kingpin, which sounds so negative, really. I like to think of you as somebody that made the party happen a little bit faster. I mean, who are we to judge, right, Sean?
Yeah, I did in my drug-addled mind when I was doing these things on the weekends, you know, I was high on ecstasy, Xanax, ketamine, GHB, assorted Mexican pharmaceuticals. In my mind, I'm keeping the party going.
Yeah.
That's what I saw. But when I got in the jail and I saw the horror of what drug use led to, 90% of the guys injecting heroin, crystal meth, 2/3 hepatitis C, I did feel ashamed of putting people on that road because it ends in the prison, police, or death. And that's why I speak to kids now in schools to put them off.
Yeah, it's one thing. I mean, look, we've all done things that maybe we wouldn't do in our older years than we did when we were younger. And I, you know, you got a different perspective on this. And look, I lived in Los Angeles, and during the time that you were doing, you know, involved in this trafficking operation in Arizona, I understand the club scene and the raves. It's a big deal. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a belief, and I'm sure you understand this as well, that there are some drugs that are really bad for you, and there are some drugs that are mildly bad for you and kind of have some therapeutic uses and have some, you know, some fun purposes. I mean, there's ecstasy, which is known as a party drug. It's been used in therapeutic settings, at least it was in Texas for a long time, for marriage therapy and everything. There's some psychological benefits to it, but like anything, there, you know, if you abuse it or you go down the wrong path, you can put yourself in a dangerous situation. I always looked at things like heroin and cocaine trafficking and methamphetamine sales. I really always thought of that as being extremely dangerous and kind of if you were selling that, you were really sort of asking for trouble and you were harming your neighborhood and your community and everything. But the ecstasy or marijuana sales, I always wrote that off as kind of like, you know, buyer beware, like it wasn't necessarily the most harmful thing. When you went into the prison system when you were busted for this, is there a hierarchy of as far as the drugs that you sold? Did that put, was somebody at the top of the food chain because they're a cocaine trafficker? Did they look down on you for selling ecstasy? Did they laugh at you for getting caught at something like that? Or was it, or did you have, you know, clout because you were running a multi-million-dollar drug trafficking operation?
Okay. So I was arrested with a group of people And they separated me from my co-defendants when I arrived at Towers Jail, which was part of Sheriff Joe Pyle's jail system. So the Aryan Brotherhood skinheads come up to me right away. And they're like, what are your charges? What are your charges? Now, I was new to it. So I said I didn't know what my charges meant because it was all legal terminology. Mm-hmm. So they got me against the wall, about to smash me, thinking I'm like hiding my charges. I'm a sex offender or something.
Right.
But in the end, they want to see your paperwork. So it's print. It's on a printout. So my charges were conspiracy, crime syndicate, using electronic device in a drug transaction, continuous criminal enterprise. And on the conspiracy charge, they had a $750,000 bond. And on the crime syndicate charge, they had me as person A. Now, I didn't understand any of this, but they did. So they were like, whoa. They thought it was the coolest thing in the world. They were like, who are you guys, the mafia? Who did you kill? And as soon as, you know, 1 minute they're about to attack me because they thought I was a chomo. Next thing, they're reading my charges and they're just loving it to high heaven. So that got me protection. But then they found out that I had been arrested with other people and that my co-defendant Wildman, huge guy who I grew up with, and that he was in there with me. And that was it then. I didn't get attacked, at least in those first couple of years when I was in that jail. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, in the hockey world, Gretzky, when Wayne Gretzky was coming up in Edmonton, he always had Marty McSorley as his enforcer that was with him. When he got traded to the Kings, Marty came with him as well. So anyone that hit Gretzky had to deal with Marty. So I always sort of figured that Wildman was like your Marty McSorley. Like if anything went off with you, they could expect a visit from that maniac in the cell pretty shortly.
He's a good person to get arrested with.
Yeah, I would imagine. That guy, I mean, talk about needing his own podcast. Ooh, wild man. He's an interesting fella. So I'm assuming that your experience with the law or being arrested didn't happen in your childhood. This was maybe a first for you when the cops bust your door down?
I was in my 30s. Yeah. All my crimes I'd done mostly in my 20s.
Oh yeah,
and I'd actually quit the importation when they caught up with me. I'd already quit for over a year. I was in my early 30s, met a woman, fall in love. I thought they had to catch you with the drugs. I didn't understand the statute of limitations.
Yeah.
It's 7 years in Arizona. All it takes is someone from your past 7 years to tell the police they've done a transaction with you, and they've got you. They've got a witness.
So explain to me how it all starts. You start, you're selling stocks, you're making $500,000 a year, having a great, by all accounts, that's a great life, partying on the weekends, start to recognize, like a lot of us did, maybe, hey, it's dangerous to go out and buy pills individually. Maybe I just buy them in, I've got some money. Maybe I just buy a big bag of them and then I've got them for every weekend, right? And then me and my friends, we can go party and we don't have to go search this out and go through this exercise every single Friday, you know, afternoon leading into the weekend. So you buy a big batch and then that turns into, why don't I buy a bigger batch? Is that how it goes? And then
you've nailed it. Have you read Party Time, my book or something? Because that explains it all in that.
No, I just kind of lived that same sort of thing.
You never got caught.
No, but I can understand. So that's part of the reason why one of the many reasons why I connected with you on this was because I can understand how this can get a little bit out of control. How it can start off as I'm just trying to make things easier on me and my buddies if we're going to go, you know, partake in this sort of stuff. Let's just stock up, so to speak. And then how that can turn into, well, hey, I've got a friend that wants some too. Like, okay, well then I can get you. So as things start to grow, you realize that you've got to sort of move this operation, or you've got to at least start digging in down the supply chain and see if you can get closer and closer to the source to try and get things a little bit cheaper, I would imagine, right? Where does that lead you? Does that lead you out of Arizona and where?
Okay, so in Arizona, the local dealers could only get us about 50 to 100 pills. And my guy, Acid Joey, was hooking these deals up through the local dealers. So I say to Acid Joey, we need to find out where they're getting it from. And he found out they were getting it from this guy out of LA called Sol. So I get money together to buy 1,000 pills. I arrange this transaction, go out there. I take two carloads of us, got Wildman, Acid Joey, got this other huge guy. Acid Joey and the other huge guy are dead now. Seth, his name is. Most of my party friends are dead now, actually, from back then, because they were such high-risk lifestyle people. And we're waiting outside this guy's house for hours in West Hollywood, I think it was. And he shows
up. Wildman fit right in West Hollywood. Holy people that don't know, West Hollywood is the very gay section of Los Angeles. I could imagine Wildman just sitting around going, "What the fuck is going on with all these people here?"
Well, Wildman has lived with trans people and gay people and Native American transgender streetwalkers. And he has a real affinity for the an eclectic community, let's say. Everywhere he lived, the parties would have various people over from all. You'd have trans talking to Russian mafia, Italian mafia, Mexican mafia, street gang bangers. And what I did was, anyone who owed me money, Wildman didn't beat them up. The threat was that Wildman would move in with you because he was unhelpful.
That's even worse.
Wildman had destroyed so many houses, had blown up and gone on fire, not on purpose, places he was trying to live just because he was so wild. No, he was banned from all the hotels, so housing him was a difficult thing. So if anyone owed me money, that was it. Wildman was moving in. Within days of him moving in, he'd just show up and say, "You owe Sean money. All right, well, I'm coming in. Sit on your sofa." And within hours, runners for the Mexican mafia would be like carrying out your TV and your microwave, and there'd be nothing you could do with it. There would be people manufacturing crack cocaine in your kitchen. He had an alliance with a guy who was working for the Cali cartel, who was running crack through central Phoenix. And like I said, the party would just begin. It would not stop. Place would just get completely ruined. And usually the person who lived there would move out within 2 to 3 weeks.
Oh my God! So you're in West Hollywood. You're going to buy your first boat of ecstasy. And yeah. Okay, so that happens, and then what?
So Sol shows up finally with a bunch of guys with surfboards. And if you ever seen that movie Point Break, They were like straight out of that, surfer gangsters. I go in there and I leave everybody in the cars. I said to Wildman, "Look." Wildman's like, "Let's just steam in. He shouldn't have kept us waiting this long. Let's just go in and take his shit." I'm like, we've got to build a relationship here. Otherwise, how are we going to, you know? So I go in on my own. I say, "If I'm not in 15 minutes, you steam in then." I go in. I say, "I got the bills. Where's the pills?" And Sol goes out and comes back from this other room with the biggest bag of pills I've ever seen. I can't remember if they were Euro dollars, Mitsubishis. Or what they were, something like that. And I say to him, "All right, can I try one first?" Because I would always chew my pills. I was told very early on that if you chew your pills, it goes through your digestive system more easily and gets you higher faster, or you know, you absorb it better or something. Mm-hmm. And by doing that over the years, I'd learned the exact taste of a good pill. Mm-hmm. Should be 100, 125 milligrams of MDMA and clay. Usually like a beige or a white press back then. None of that colored crap that had the counterfeit chemicals in it. So I'm chewing this pill. He's like, "Do you want a drink?" I'm like, no, I just want to taste it. He's looking at me like I'm crazy. So I'm chewing the pill. I'm like, "Yeah, it's good." We do the deal. Get back to Arizona. And Wildman is moved into an apartment in Tempe, Arizona, in this huge complex. And those pills just go in like a weekend, and I'm thinking, all right, there's an arbitrage opportunity here. They're going for 25 to 30, getting for 10 out of LA, and it ends up with me getting them for like $2 or $3 out of Holland, up to 40,000 pills at a time. getting them smuggled in through Mexico, got operations in Mexico, got alliances down there. And my competitor at the peak of it is Sammy the Bull Gravano, on the boss of the Gambinos, who murdered almost 24 people.
Yeah, that's a problem. So the goal is, like you said, an arbitrage opportunity here. Let's see if we can compress this supply chain down. You cut out as many people as you can, work backwards to get to as close to Holland as you can. So it's $10 in LA. And you were able to get him down to what, at the height of it, you're able to get him down to what's the best price you were able to get out of LA?
Best price I got out of LA ever was probably about 7 or 8.
Okay.
Yeah, but they could only get 5 to 10,000. So by the time I'm going through Holland, I've got people out of LA calling me at that point. It's reversed.
Oh. So you decide, let's figure out where this goes. I had always heard that it was coming out of either Holland or Israel. And So I knew that that was sort of where the chain would begin. So did you meet some Dutch connection, or did you get introduced to somebody, or how does this, I mean, at what point do you realize, okay, this has gone beyond, like, I could sell 1,000 of them a weekend, to I need to be able to pick up 40,000, 50,000 at a time. When did this click over for you? Did it take a couple of months? Did it take a couple of weeks? I mean, how long before you realized, okay, we need to be doing this on a much bigger scale?
So I did some business integration. I started to throw ecstasy parties, huge raves, you know, for up to 10,000 people at a time. Mm-hmm. And I had my own security team, bouncers. So I locked down the house then at those parties. If someone comes in selling pills that I've not supplied, they're recycled back to the house. Mm. So when it was at that level, I got about 200 people working for me. You need tens of thousands of pills to keep going. And no matter how many we got, they just flew.
Yeah. And what year is this?
Okay, so this was 96, 97. Going up into the late 90s, you know, I quit after the millennium, and SWAT team came May 16th, 2002.
Okay. So you're still working as a stockbroker at this time?
There was some overlap. Wildman's first visit kind of ended my stockbroking career.
Oh, jeez.
I put him in an apartment by the George and Dragon British pub in Central Phoenix, thinking that he would just go in and drink with the expats and he wouldn't get in trouble. I had an idealistic notion to get him a job as a wrestler. He'd been in prison in the UK. Yep. He said there was red dots in his head from being a teenager that told him to hurt people. So I thought, you know, we could channel that into him being a wrestler. Mm-hmm. So a month or so later, me and my girlfriend go to Wildman's apartment and he's not there. And a bunch of Mexicans answer the door. I'm like, where's Peter? It's like, no, we didn't order a pizza. I'm like, no, not pizza. Pizza, where's Peter? He lives here. And then they all pull guns. Me and my girlfriend are backtracking. Wildman strides over the street and he goes, oh, don't worry about them. They're all local crack dealers. They like to move around a lot, so I've rented them the place. The guy in the back there is a Colombian, the boss from Colombia, and he wants to invest money in the stock market. He's a good dude. Come in and talk to him. They're buzzing because I can inhale $100 crack rock in one breath, and they're giving me all this crack for free, and I'm loving it. It just goes sizzle, sizzle, ding, 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 ding in my head. And that was it then. He would just stay up literally for up to 2 weeks at a time. No sleep whatsoever, just smoking crack and smoking crystal meth. Ooh. But it was through him, wherever you put Wildman in the world, wherever he resides, all of the street people and the night people, he takes control of them. We were in Hollywood. We were on Sunset Boulevard and we went to a rave and we'd come back. And all the street people all night long are knocking on the hotel door dropping off drugs for Wild Man. We ended up leaving him there with a guy who was staying at the hotel with a kilo of cocaine, and he was in a Viper car. So that's just, you know, I was the shy one starting out in this criminal partnership. And Wild Man just opened all these doors. So in Arizona, he starts having these parties, and that's where I made all of the connections, especially the New Mexican Mafia connection, that led to the it was the foundation of the criminal enterprise. But Wild Man didn't last long. He ended up, like I said earlier, he was completely unhousable on that first visit. He ended up living in Tempe Beach Park with a stripper under a tree with a Rambo knife and a baseball bat. Those two were doing like Bonnie and Clyde, they were, you know, doing all kinds of scams and going in restaurants and running away and not paying. And they got caught leaving a restaurant, and they saw that he'd overstayed his visa. I mean, I was a legal alien as well. I was there for years over my visa. And so he got banned for life from America for being a menace to society. But as things grew, as my resources grew, I started to send Mission Impossible style teams of people around the world to bring him back into the country, smuggling him through Mexico and Canada. And I did that multiple times. He ended up getting deported 3 times.
He's like trying to smuggle drugs in. It's easier to smuggle drugs in than Wild Man.
Yeah, totally. Totally easier, because he's just, he'd be high as a kite just trying to get across the border. There's a point where they got him coming in near Tijuana, and they said to him, like, come with us, basically, you know, we're going to apprehend you. Him and Wild Woman, his girlfriend, who was just as tough as him. And somehow he knocked the immigration people over, and they ran off into Tijuana and managed to escape. but I had to send another crew to get him and bring him in at another point at the border. But yeah, it's like bringing, you know, to like Bonnie and Clyde, trying to bring them over on Bonnie and Clyde on crystal meth.
Oh my God! So yeah. he's both simultaneously an asset and a liability, right?
I've debated this my life throughout my life. I know he would take a bullet for me, but a lot of heat came our way because of his behavior.
Yeah, that's funny. So was the New Mexican Mafia, were they running ecstasy as well? Could you
partner up with? No, that's the thing. You mentioned a lot of drugs earlier, and they control that in Arizona. So I will be stepping on their toes. So I was a novelty to them, because I was this English guy bringing in this substance that they'd never heard of.
Yeah. What are the profit margins? Are they better in cocaine and heroin than they are in ecstasy? Or is it just that even though the profit margin, I mean, if the profit margins are less in ecstasy, is it still a better move because the heat is not as directed on you by the police, or how does that all work? Obviously, you're not going to step on their toes or you'll get killed. But since they're not moving ecstasy, they didn't have a problem with you doing it. Were they not concerned with it because they didn't know about it, or were they not concerned about it because they didn't find it to be as profitable as what they were currently doing with heroin and cocaine?
All right, there's a lot of questions, so let me see if I can remember them. The reason I got in with them was because at one of Wild Man's apartment party situations, one of them came there. He wasn't a full member, but he was the brother of a member, let's say. Mm-hmm. And his name was G-Dog, and he's supplying like the coke and the weed. I'm supplying the ecstasy. So I get talking to G-Dog. Cop walks in, says, I can smell weed from outside, nobody move. Goes to grab his radio, he's going to call it in, have us all arrested. G-Dog just pulls a gun out, points at the cop's face, says, the only one who's not leaving is you, motherfucker, everybody run. Now, helicopters came, dogs came, everything, and we protected him. We moved him around, I took him over to Phoenix, and he said, because you protected me and my brothers have got your back. So that's how I got in with those guys. I went over to the house, and they got a rocket-propelled grenade launch on top of the TV. Yeah. And I didn't even know who they were, and I didn't even know what he meant. My brothers have got your back. And I didn't even know who they were for years. I was in business with them for years. And then one night, I'm taking G-Dog to his brother's house. The whole neighborhood is blacked out. The police are guiding traffic with light wands, like Darth Vader-style light, you know, the sabers. And then they bring all those guys out in handcuffs. We would have been in that SWAT team raid if we got there a little bit earlier. So all the mugshots were headline news, and it said these are the leaders of the New Mexico Mafia, most powerful, dangerous criminal organization in Arizona at the time.
Wow.
They tried to assassinate the head of the prison system. They're assassinating witnesses, police, trying to assassinate a judge, everything, yeah.
But they knew you were cool. They knew that you were willing to harbor one of their guys who just currently did something that would land him in prison for decades, I would imagine, pulling a gun on a cop. And you were willing to say, that's fine. We'll turn the lights off and you can hide in the closet of this apartment. I think I've heard you tell the story how they were looking for everybody and you guys laid there all night and didn't make a sound. So I would imagine that buys you some brownie points with the cartel. Yeah.
Well, they weren't the cartel. Let's get that clear.
Okay.
So I had operations in Mexico, and that, you know, my relationship with people in Mexico came about through Wild Man. So those people would be associated with the cartel, let's say.
Okay.
In America, you've got, in Arizona and California, you've got a group called the New Mexican Mafia. Mm-hmm. And they are Chicanos. So they are Mexican Americans. And actually, in the prison system, the Mexican nationals are at war with the Chicanos.
Okay.
It's crazy.
So La M.A. is not New Mexican Mafia.
La M.A. is the New Mexican Mafia, but that's not the cartel.
Oh, okay.
The cartel is the Mexican Mafia. So you got like the Juarez cartel, the Sinaloa cartel.
Okay.
They're the ones who are right now have got more money than small countries and are dominating the cocaine business.
Okay. And so were they at war with each other or did they work with each other?
In the prison system, when I was housed and Wellman was housed, that was I went in 2002. The New Mexican Mafia, the Chicanos, were at war with the Mexican nationals. Mm. And Wildman said he saw some of the worst violence in his life over that kind of activity.
Yeah. So by the time 2002 rolls around, well, let's see. You had gone out, you got arrested in 2002, but you had actually stopped the dealing, you said, by the 99. Is that right?
No, probably like just after the millennium.
Just after the millennium. Okay.
Yeah, about a year before I got caught, and I got caught May 16th, 2002.
Okay. So at that height, at the height of the operation, what were you importing a month in terms of pills?
Oh, yeah. And to answer your question as well about profit margin.
Yeah.
So it was sporadic, but the most anyone ever brought in was 40,000 pills. So that could last. That was that month, but maybe the next month we didn't bring any pills in. So maybe that would last for like 2 or 3 months.
Gotcha.
And people run the math then. They say, all right, Sean, you said it costs $2, $3 out of Holland. $25, $30 is what they're going for on the streets. And they assume I make all that money. But I had it structured like a corporation. Mm-hmm. So I've got all these different divisions. The head of each faction would come to me, for example. I would give them 5,000 pills on credit at $10 a pill. Mm-hmm. He then gives them to his middleman. And then they get out on the streets, you know, and so on and so on. So there's all these different profit brackets that people don't understand unless they can see it from the inside. But even so, 40,000 pills, $10, say I'm getting on average. If I'm paying three at the most, that includes like legal fees and all the other bullshit, mm-hmm. then 7 times 40,000 is what, 208, quarter million?
Yeah. That's a lot. So you were still, as you moved that supply chain closer to the district or to the source of it, your profit really wound up staying the same, because if you're buying it for 10 and selling them for 20 back in the LA days when you're getting it, well, now you're buying them for 2, selling them for 10, you're still making just about the same, but you're getting just a massive amount. And you're taking yourself one step away from being a street level dealer where you have to interact with the general public. Now you're only dealing with what, 5 or 6 different salespeople of yours?
Exactly. The amount of money I'm making per pill is the same, but if you look at the return on the investment, if I'm putting $3 in and I'm getting 10,
yeah,
that's, you know, 200%, mm-hmm, versus it's just a double if I'm going from 10 to 20.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, okay. So how does it work? How do you get it from Holland? Of course, people know that is, I knew, I don't know if everybody knew, but I'm assuming if I knew, then the police knew that was a major distribution hub for this sort of thing. I would imagine they had a lot of eyes on that region of the world to see where all this stuff was being manufactured and see if it was coming out. So how do you get it out of there? How do you go from there, from Holland to Mexico in a straight shot? Is that how it works? And then from Mexico in?
It was a learning process over the years. So in the beginning, I got testing kits from a website called Dance Safe. Yeah. And they turned the color of ecstasy like this blue-purple. You know it's a good quality pill. Mm-hmm. And then I just put people on flights because I couldn't leave the country because I was an illegal alien. I just told them to get some samples and come back, make the relationship. And that's what they did. And then we experimented with various methods of bringing the pills back. From mailing them in corporate annual reports, glued into them, pills strapped on people's bodies, pills in luggage. And one lady, she got to Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. They were in vitamin jar containers in her luggage. They stopped her, took her in the back room, took them out, put them on the table, said to her, "What are they?" She said, "Vitamins." They said, "Cool." Put them back into her luggage and told her to have a nice day. So after that, I thought, right, I need to speak to a professional, an expert in smuggling techniques. So I went to a lawyer, and the lawyer said, start bringing them in through Mexico.
Wow. I love this lawyer. Who is this lawyer? Sal from Better Call Sal?
Pretty much, yeah. No names. No names shall be mentioned.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. So, but I love this guy's legal advice.
So it's now...
The lawyer from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, right?
So I put Wild Man and Wild Woman in Mexico. They're like so hot in Arizona that it's all heading to a close. So I put them in Mexico. And my friends say, well, if the wild ones start misbehaving in Mexico, the Mexicans will kill them. And I sent people down there. They didn't have cell phones. There was no cell phone signal or something. I sent people down there to see if they were doing okay. And the house, the person came back terrified, saying the house had been burnt down, all the windows were blown out, the Mexicans have killed them. So I'm like, oh, shit. So I sent another guy, Frankie Flowers. He was ex-military sniper, and he spoke Spanish. He goes down there, speaks to the locals. The wild ones had a fight. They took a cigarette break during this fight. During the fight, apparently, they cracked the gas pipe. So when they lit up the cigarette for the cigarette break, a blue carpet of flames just spread through the house. Wild Man grabbed Wild Woman. He's running out of the house with her. And the whole house blows up, Hollywood style. And the fire response, it was like antiquated. It was like, it took like an hour for this fire engine to come, and it was like, you know, one of these little push cart things.
Yeah.
Anyway, he made such a mark in Mexico, Wild Man, that you know, they were running him around in military vehicles, and he was giving all the police drugs, and that's how it is, because there's a symbiotic relationship between the cartel and the cops. So we had, you know, we knew the right people down there. I invested in beachfront property, Hotel Peñasco, Rocky Point. And I've got people now coming down, you know, in like student vehicles, University of Arizona stickers on them. And then a person will fly from Tijuana, Mexico City, Air France to Paris, train over to Holland, and they would come back on that route. Come back to Puerto Penasco. We switched the pills to somebody else. You know, they got this SUV, University of Arizona sticker on it, diving tanks, tourist bric-a-brac. And nobody ever got busted transporting those pills over the Arizona border.
Wow, that's amazing. Did you have it wrapped in something to disguise the smell? I'm sure the police dogs could smell ecstasy. It has a very distinct smell to it.
No, they couldn't, because they only couldn't. Specially trained beagles can smell it.
Oh.
Yeah, and I ordered everybody never, ever carry weed, go near weed, expose yourself to weed smoke when you're on a mission, and somebody fell foul of that. So my right-hand man, Cody Bates, he's dead now as well. He was the guy who rented an apartment just for the cash, and he would go around and collect the cash from the heads of the factions and distribute the pills. He took one of his best friends to Holland, and it was his best friend's birthday, bought him some hydroponic weed. Because he'd never been to Holland before, he wanted to show it off to his friends in America. They got 10,000 plus pills. They're at a checkpoint in France. Sniffer dog just walks right up to the guy with the weed, paws him like that, and he's busted. Cody Bates goes to the men's room and flushed his stuff and got through. Now, everybody who worked for me had legal benefits. We would sign him a lawyer. We'd get him bail bonded out. If he didn't have criminal history, you know, we could usually get him out quite easily, and they wouldn't snitch as well, so it protected us. But with this guy, because it was international trafficking, the best we could get him was like 2 years in a French prison. And by the time he got out, he could speak French.
Oh, well, that's a benefit. Now he can work that route. So at the height of this, what's this empire worth? I mean, how do you measure that?
Here's the stupid thing, Charlie. All it was worth was ego. I was worth $2 million in the stock market from my own legal activity. I bought shares in a company called Pacific Satellite Nonsatra. I bought, it was around $3 to $5 when I started accumulating it. I think I had at least 30,000, and that went up to over 50 in the dot-com bubble. There were days I just wake up, I'm living on a $1 million house on the side of a mountain in Sin Vacas, and you know, the Catalina Hotels in Tucson, most beautiful place I've ever lived. There were days I'd wake up and my portfolio was up six figures. But, you know, I was the man. I was throwing parties. I was bringing all these pills in. And it's like, you know, Pablo Escobar, they said to him, why don't you quit? You know, while you're ahead, his brother said, let's buy our own island. We won't get arrested. We won't get killed. You're worth billions. And he's like, I'm running this organization, you know, employing tens of thousands of people. My money puts the president of Colombia in power. I decide who the president is going to be. And you want me to kick back on a deck chair on some island, you know, sipping a margarita. It's addiction to the lifestyle and ego. And my ego is as big as the Grand Canyon. Now, in terms of, you know, quantifying it, there was an article in the newspaper that came out quite quickly when I got arrested, because it was the same cops that arrested me as Sammy the Bull. And they said, yes, Sammy the Bull came in, but he didn't last long, because I lasted for all those years. You know, it was multi-million street value operation. And they reckoned that, you know, I did a multiple of what Sammy the Bull did in his short run. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the house where the money goes. You probably found one of the problems, one of the surprising problems that the drug kingpins discover is that it's easier to import drugs and sell drugs than it is to deal with the cash that you have from this operation. So how do you go about laundering this cash? Where do you, you know, there's only so many things you can buy with a duffel bag filled with $20 bills, but at some point you've got to put this money to work for you, or you've got to wash it somehow. And so my guess is, if you've gone to the extent of having, you know, legal services provided and a game plan and a strategy for everyone, you've also gone and taken the additional step of trying to figure out how the hell you're going to launder all this fucking money that you've got all of a sudden. So how do you, what's the process for that?
I do a 1-hour talk on how I laundered the money to investment banks in London. And because I couldn't get a visa to travel to Hong Kong, the head of Hong Kong Shanghai Bank came out and filmed with me some of what I said about this, because they were nailed for laundering cartel money.
Yeah.
And in summary then, well, I started following the stock market when I was 14, started trading it when I was 16. I traded in the options market as a teenager. In the stock market, I was a licensed stockbroker. I had a manager's license. I was a licensed options trader. And through the options market, that's what woke me up, was seeing the trades that came in before 9/11, betting the airlines would go down. That was my wake-up call.
Yeah.
Later confirmed in the David Icke book, Alice in Wonderland, which I read in jail, those trades were traced back to an investment bank, you know, run by ex-CIA. So I had the skill set to create a spider's web of accounts.
Yeah.
And I flew people over from the UK. I would pay for them to go on, you know, these holidays here in America, shopping sprees. They'd be met with limos at the airport, take them straight to a car dealership, have them sign for cars, rent apartments in their names. And, you know, to facilitate the criminal enterprise, I've got cars in people's names who aren't even in the country. The cops pull them over. Where's that going to trace to? If they raid an apartment in one of these names, where's that going to trace to? We had investments in rave, clothing, music stores. The ravers called me the Bank of England. That was one of my nicknames. And they would come to me and say, look, I've got an idea for a party. But yeah, I'll put the money up, but I want you to pay me back in checks payable to these names of these, you know, these people I've flown over from the UK. And once that money went to the banks, then it went into the stock market accounts and just, you know, through this web of financial transactions, which I don't think the police ever, I looked at all the legal discovery, and even though they had a NetBus Trojan horse virus in my computer showing them everything, there was so much stock market information coming in, it overloaded the system. They had to fly these software engineers from the Department of Justice into Arizona to try and help them cope with it. So they never really got to the bottom of all of that. And but I did end up losing it all anyway, because I went heavy into the stock market with it. And we had the dot-com bubble crashed.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of it was leveraged as well.
Yeah.
So it all imploded, you know. But even if I had any left, the cops would have taken it anyway. So at the peak of it, I really went to town with it, living in $1 million house on the side of the mountain, paying the rent on 10 to 20 other properties as well, at least 10 car payments I'm paying for. You know, so we've got all these different safe houses and places I'm paying for. Drugs, you know, for example, in one apartment complex, these complexes were huge, like Rancho Marietta in Tempe, Arizona. So I've got one apartment at the front, which is distributing. I've got one apartment in the middle, which is the money is getting siphoned back to. And I've got one apartment at the back, where if anything gets heavy, you know, there's some problem solvers there that are going to come out and handle the situation. That's just one example.
Wow. Did you figure this out on your own? Did you figure this? I mean, were your conversations with these guys that for the New Mexican Mafia, were they telling you how they ran operations? I mean, how would you think of having three apartments in the same complex with different, I suppose that, you know, this happens quite a bit, but I'm just curious how you came about. Did you develop this system yourself, or was this something that you kind of learned from these guys that had more experience with it?
Okay, so when Wildman was no longer houseable in Phoenix, Arizona, the last place he lived at in Phoenix, Arizona, I'd paid the rent, they were behind on payments, and I put him with this steroid head bouncer from some dodgy club on Van Buren. He was claiming he was like a gangster disciple and he had all this long permed hair. I got a call from the apartment manager saying that that guy had been seen running away from the apartment with plasterboard on his face, and that Wildman had done it and he was getting evicted. I said, well, how do you know Wildman did it? And she's like, well, they had all these human head-sized holes in his room. This guy was seen running. So, all right. So I managed to stop the check on that one and move Wildman over to Tempe into Rancho Murrieta. Now, that first ecstasy experiment, the 1,000 pills, the bowl, that was sold through the Rancho Murrieta apartment. But that was also, the apartment complex where G-Dog pulled the gun on the cop. And we were able to flee to another apartment and hide in that complex. So I think that incident set the stage in my mind for what was to come. You got to have multiple apartments in a huge complex like this to keep everything safe.
Wow. Okay. So then we fast forward to the point where they show up. How'd they figure out that you were involved in this? I mean, they ultimately caught you. You were arrested. You were convicted and everything. But who put you in the limelight, and what happened?
There's more informants in America than there are police, and there was 10 witnesses that came forward. And you said before about stuff I learned from the New Mexico Mafia. And what I did learn is, I did learn a lot from them. They said, if you ever get pulled over leaving here, tell the cop you're exercising your right to remain silent. If they say, can I search your car? Say, no, I'm in a hurry. Do you have a warrant? And they also told me, get this lawyer. If things get heavy, get this lawyer. And that's what I ended up doing. And he was a loophole lawyer. And if it wasn't for him, it was almost 100 grand. If it wasn't for him, I'd still probably be in prison because I was facing a maximum 200-year sentence.
Oh, Lord. So that's got to screw with your head. So you finally, you get arrested and what are the, they obviously what they always do is stack charges. Like you said, give you the idea that you're going to face 200 years in prison. Yeah. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But the fact that that's a possibility is usually enough to get people to start crumbling and start talking. And you mentioned at the beginning with the David Icke that you're a co-conspirator, you're letter B. How does that work? That's not some flippant term that they use when they described you as being letter B. There's a police methodology to this, right? Where these letters mean something. Explain what that means exactly.
Yeah, in the David Icke conspiracy, I am letter B as a collaborator, according to what are they called? The Center for Countering Digital Hate.
Yeah.
In my case, I was letter A. So I was at the head of the crime syndicate. And then Wild Woman was letter B, and Wild Man was letter C, and so on and so on. It went down the ranks. And when they run out of letters, it goes to AA, BB, CC, like that, because they arrested over 100 people over the months.
So, okay, so they get you in, they stack all these charges, you're looking at 200 years or so, you've got this great attorney, and what in the end do you wind up, I'm assuming, plea bargaining down to?
I signed for 9.5 years, and as a first-time nonviolent drug offender who was not a U.S. citizen, I only had to serve just under 6.
If you had been Sean Jenkins from Compton, what would you have been looking at?
Oh, if I'd have been a black guy with no money and a public defender, and I'd have done the crimes I'd done, I'd still be in prison.
Oh, that's so screwed up.
I heard a cop say, I just, to get my arrest quotas, I just go into a black neighborhood. It's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Oh, that's so disgusting. So you go into prison or first jail and then prison, and not just any jail, but Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail. Now, this guy has a PR team around him that has been selling this douchebag as the no-nonsense cop that every city in America needs, but is afraid to hire. So I want to know your opinion on Sheriff Joe from somebody that, that goes beyond the pink boxers and the black and white striped outfits that he uses to dehumanize people. What is this? What's it really like living in one of his jails?
Well, Sheriff Joe Arpaio's mom died giving birth to him. Mm-hmm. So my assessment of the situation is he has no maternal empathy bond. And the jail became a house of horrors, which was a projection of his own internal turmoil. He worshipped Harry Anslinger. He worked under Harry Anslinger. He had a photo of Harry Anslinger on his office until he was, lost the last election as sheriff. And Harry Anslinger was the guy who foisted drug laws on the entire world and marketed it by saying that a black man or a Mexican on drugs would want to rape every white woman in sight. And the main reason to make drugs illegal is their effect on the degenerate races.
Ooh.
Yeah. So, Arpaio comes from that drug war dinosaur mentality, tough on crime. And there is something in the human mind that roots for punishment. They feel that prisoners have cheated society and they deserve to be punished. And Arpaio channeled that support meticulously over the years. He created a Hollywood front to disguise the House of Horrors. He had his own TV shows, Smile, You're Under Arrest, Inmate Idol, always out doing these publicity stunts. But behind the scenes, he created the jail that's got the highest rate of death in America.
Wow.
National Geographic Channel researched it for my Locked Up Abroad episode. They said 62 people died in there over 5 years around the time I was there. 50 million paid out in lawsuits, more than the top five jails combined. And they weren't just, prisoners murdering prisoners like the Aryan Brotherhood gang members. This was like guards murdering mentally ill prisoners. I've got videos of guards murdering mentally ill prisoners on my YouTube channel. And the family members of the victims of the guards sued. And because their videos, the federal court forced them to release the video footage and showed the guards murdering them as evidence. Later on, Arpaio promoted some of the guards who were found responsible in federal court for murdering those prisoners.
Wow. That sounds like, the military. It sounds like the same sort of thing that happens in the FBI. When you become a dirty FBI agent and get busted, they seem to promote you. What a reprehensible scumbag. So when you go to prison, you agree to 9.5 years. Are you thinking you're going to have to serve all 9.5 years, or do you think there's an outside chance that you're going to be done in six? Or was it six or seven?
All right. So I'm fighting my case for 26 months. That was the most stressful time because of the uncertainty. Within weeks, they slapped serious drug offender status on me, which carries 25 to life. I had around over 10 charges, which carried 5 to 10 years each. And because people weren't cooperating, they thought we were all going to roll over like Sammy the Bull's crew.
Mm-hmm.
57 people got arrested with him, and they all agreed to cooperate. Over 100 people got arrested with me, and we're into the second year of this case, and only four have agreed to cooperate because we were such a close-knit organization and like a crime family of misfits. So the prosecutors have the domino theory. We arrest all these people, and once they all start snitching, we've got such a solid case. But we're in the second year now. They've got four people who've cooperated, and they didn't have a shred of evidence on me other than these witnesses. So the case was getting staler and getting weaker. But they did make it clear in the second year that if I did go to trial, it costs the state money. They make an example of you. And a guy from Tucson who had a similar case, he refused a 15-year plea bargain, went to trial, and they gave him 200 years. And they said that was going to happen to me. So, you're looking at each other over this chessboard, and your hand is in the fate of the judge, prosecutor, the skills of your lawyer, and your whole life is in the balance, and it's a terrifying thing. And it was so terrifying that there was a point there where I just, I was at the brink of just suicidal insanity, and I planned to just slash my wrists and bleed out. But it was looking at the photos of my mom, dad, girlfriend, sister, gave me the strength not to do that. And I'm not trying to, say this for pity. I put myself in there, take full responsibility for committing my crimes. And I did deserve to be punished. And it did send my life in this whole new positive direction.
Yeah. So when you go into prison, you got to have, I feel like I've watched every documentary ever. I watched Raving Arizona on National Geographic Channel before I knew who you were. And so I remembered it when you came about. And the first time I think I heard you was on Richie Allen years ago. And so I know, you know, after watching all these prison documentaries, and not to say that I know what goes on in prison, but I do know that in an ideal situation, you develop some sort of hustle, some sort of way to make or generate additional income so that you can live and not have to eat the disgusting food that's in there. So as English Sean, the drug trafficker who comes to prison, what is your hustle? What sets you apart from everybody else? My guess has got to be your education.
My education became my currency. Yeah. So you got guys in there who can't read. I write about a third of them. When I got moved from medium security to maximum security in my second year, and I walk in there with the prison war, acting like a tough guy, go to the table with the Woods, the Whites, you know, throwing out all the prison slang because they're going to make a decision right away whether they're going to accept me or brutalize me. Go back to my cell, sweating it out. The leader of the gang comes down with all of his legal paperwork.
he smelled right through that bullshit.
Yeah. I was an asset to him. And he asked me to read his legal paperwork and give me my thoughts on what kind of a plea bargain range he would be realistic.
Wow. So you became the jailhouse attorney?
No, I didn't become a jailhouse attorney. Those guys really specialize in that all day long. They're just studying the law. I could read people's legal paperwork. I could help them respond to legal documents. The Spanish, the Mexicans, a lot of them worked out in the countryside. They couldn't even speak. I'm sorry, they couldn't write Spanish. So I started a class teaching the Mexicans how to write Spanish. That was when I was in Max, and they were nearly all murderers in that class. Erin Brotherhood, part of Green, liked to have me attacked for helping the Mexicans, but my cellmate was an independent tough guy. He intervened, and I was allowed to keep the class going.
Wow. Yeah. So they don't want you even crossing racial lines but they were okay with it because of your roommate or because they needed you too?
No, they were okay with it because of my roommate. If you've ever watched one of these programs on TV, like The Last Kingdom, where everyone's constantly conspiring against everyone, and there's these new characters coming in and out constantly. One minute you're an asset to them, and next minute someone comes in who doesn't like you and starts conspiring against you. And in these jails, the environment is so transitory. People coming in and out constantly, and there's power plays by different people and different alliances. It's like that nonstop.
Wow.
Yeah, and you got to just deal with that nonstop. You got to have eyes in the back of your head.
Yeah. Is it more dangerous in jail because of all that turnover or prison? I would imagine
far more dangerous in jail.
Yeah.
There's no stability in prison. You're sentenced, you're settling down. Everyone knows everyone. In jail, people just coming in and out. It's like prison on fast forward. My book's called Hard Time because a guy who'd done a lot of time, he said to me, look, I'd rather do 3 days in prison than do 1 day in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail. He goes, this is hard time, dog. And that's why I ended up calling my jail memoir Hard Time.
Yeah, that's great. So at some point, you start the process of writing a blog, right? You start handwriting a blog, mailing it home. When did that start? Was that jail or prison?
Towards the end of the second year, I asked the guard, how do you guys get away with this? You know, the cockroaches crawling all over us at night, dead rats in the food.
Yeah.
And he said, the world has no idea what's going on in here and the public don't care about prisoners. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've got this anti-establishment thing in my head that something just clicked. I thought, right, you know, the arrogance of these people, I'm going to start showing the world somehow. And my dad had read a book, Salem Pax, the Baghdad blogger. That was the idea then, to start a blog. And my aunt, she smuggled what I wrote out of maximum security visitation, took them home, typed them up, emailed them to my parents. And that's how my blog, John's Jail Journal, came about. And it's still online now if people want to read. the original entries. And you did mention Raving Arizona as well. That's it's down off YouTube, but people can watch it on Vimeo.
Yeah. So after, so you do a couple of years, or you're coming to the end of your term. Things are, you're about to get released. You're at a position where you've got to start thinking about your future, I would imagine. So you've got, let's just take back, like, maybe you've got 6 months left while you're in prison. Wait, or do you go from prison back to jail? Do they do it like that and let you out? Or do you stay in prison before you get finally released?
Everything is complex. So because of what the prosecutor doing all dirty tricks on me, you know, the first 2 and a bit years, I went from medium security jail to maximum security jail to lockdown to supermax lockdown. Then I go over to prison system, Arizona Department of Corrections. And then from there, I go from minimum to from medium to minimum. And then I go to federal deportation.
Mm.
So the feds then, the last day is like Connor, you know. Last few days, I'm on Connor going across Arizona and California, picking up and dropping off Mexicans because it's federal deportation. Then I'm on a flight from LA to London. And then I was finally free when I landed in London.
So what was the plan? What did you, when you're sitting in prison, thinking that you've got a couple more months left before you're released, what you're thinking, okay, I'm going to get out. I'm out of America, I'm assuming you wanted to stay in America. You know, that's the reason you came. You now are a convicted felon, which means goodbye stockbroker licensing, I would assume, and things like that. You're banned. You know you're going to be banned from coming back into the United States. What are you planning as your next act when you get to back to home to the UK? Where are you going to go from there?
So the blog, John's Jail Journal, the writing attracted the interest of a literary agent. Mm. And I was completely new to the vernacular of that profession. And she started to school me and say, look, you know, you've got potential here to have a book. And when I got out, I'm thinking, you know, right, this is the path. I could become an author. And an author in the public's mind is like J.K. Rowling, Jeffrey Archer, Stephen King. And it's got the biggest misconception between what the actual income is and what people think it is.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
I had that misconception as well. So eventually I get published. My book Hard Time was published 2010, first edition. Random House picked it up. I'm thinking, right, I'm with a big publishing company, got a literary agent, I'm set. So I was selling £100,000 worth of books a year for 5 years in a row, doing book signings across the country. And I'm not talking people lined up at a table. I'm talking me and my mum stood there for hours from doors open till door closed, handing out leaflets, putting people in headlocks, making them buy the book. we're like busting our asses. 5 years in a row, £100,000 worth of books a year, which is approximately $125,000 a year. How much do you think I got from Random House? I got paid every 6 months. I got a check. How much do you think they sent me?
Oh man! Well, knowing what I know about the book industry, you probably got $2 a book. I don't know how many books did you sell. I don't know, maybe you were
It was £10 the book. I'm selling what, 10,000 copies?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe a total of $40,000 a year of that.
$2,000 every 6 months.
$2,000 every 6 months. Wow. So much for making a living selling books, huh?
So what I eventually did was I made a decision. I thought, all right, I've got this trilogy written about myself. I can keep writing about myself when there's way things more important than me. And I wrote about Escobar.
Mm-hmm.
And I ditched my publisher and got the rights back to my books. Wrote about Escobar, tied it into Narcos, keywords.
Yeah,
that became an Amazon bestseller, not an international bestseller, but an Amazon bestseller.
That's an international bestseller in my book, because Amazon has dominated this industry. If you're doing well on Amazon, like if you've got a podcast that does really well on Apple Podcasts, that's all you need. If you've got a book that does really well on Amazon and it's an Amazon bestseller, man, that's that's probably, in my opinion, better than a New York Times bestseller, because that's where people buy the books, is at Amazon, right? So that's a huge accomplishment.
It's maybe a huge accomplishment, but not the financial accomplishment of being an international bestseller. But it provided me enough money then to expand into podcasting and YouTube. I thought, I've got all this written content that can be just translated into video form. And all these, you know, so for 10 years, I'm living in my bedroom at my mate's house, you know, just being this writer. And now I've moved over to YouTube, and all these people helped me over the years get to there. I've been able to help other guys now who are getting out of prison in the same way. My first podcast guest, he ended up getting a book deal with Mirror Books. And that's completely changed the trajectory of his life. He served 34 years in the California prison for crime he hadn't committed.
Oh, was that Jamie?
Yeah, Jamie Morgan Kane. Another podcast guest. Someone sponsored him and got him an apartment in London. And he had the resources to set up his own YouTube channel. I guess called something like Crime and Justice TV. And various of my guests have been helped by the kindness of strangers, of people who've seen the stories come online. So what I learned, Charlie, was, you know, I thought money was the meaning of life. Greed is good. Gordon Gekko, Wall Street. Mm-hmm. But when I was pushed to the brink of suicidal insanity and facing the 200-year sentence, and I finally got, you know, sentenced to 9.5 years, and it was one of the happiest days of my life, I was no longer pining for my million-dollar house, my swimming pool, you know, my TV, all that stuff. Just getting my life back, that's all that mattered. And I appreciated the small things. Yeah. And I learned happiness is in your thoughts and in your heart. And it comes from helping people. And when you help people, it puts a brake on your ego. My ego was as big as the Grand Canyon. And it's good for your soul. And I think that's why we resonate, Charlie, because you're on that same mission. Yeah. You're helping people. You're exposing the New World Order. And you really shine with that enthusiasm for being able to have this line of work that is your passion.
Well, I'm fortunate that I didn't have to go through the sorts of experiences that you went through in prison. I can always be more appreciative of the things I have and the things that we're doing. And it's easy to get bogged down and, oh, I wish I had this or I wish I had that. But it's great to see you succeeding after you've had this rocky road. But what a hell of a story, man. I mean, and to see the success that you've had with the True Crime Podcast and to watch your numbers jump. Like, first time I did your show, I think you were at 200,000 subscribers. You're at 411,000 as of this right now on YouTube. And suppressed, in my opinion, probably that number should be much higher. It's so fascinating what you're doing. Your story is interesting. The things that you're able to turn this around and go to schools and speak to kids. I mean, I'll tell you what, if I was a kid and you came to my school and I heard your stories, your firsthand stories, and I saw that you and I had a similar look to each other, I would then imagine that it could happen to me, unfortunately, and that might, you know, keep me on a better path. So I think that what you're doing is phenomenal. I know some people will say, oh, well, you started off on the wrong, you know, on the wrong, yeah, started off on the wrong path. You know, when you're selling drugs, you're obviously not on the correct path. I don't know that many people would debate that, but it's not how you start, it's how you finish. And it looks like, Sean, you're finishing, not to say that you're done, but you're on a much more fulfilling path for sure. And I am really fascinated to see where things shake out for you. I could definitely see you having your own, you know, how ironic if you had your own Netflix series, you know, where you're able to go into the details of your past, because God knows I've seen enough prison documentaries on Netflix and everything to have another voice, I think would be great. And so if people want to check out your work or buy your books, what's the best place to, how do you direct them? What's the best place to go?
Yeah. Have we got enough time just to say something in conclusion before I do that?
Please do.
Yeah. Okay. So people say, you know, do these talks to the kids work? And I go in, you know, rough inner city schools. I go in some of the more preeminent schools like Stowe and Westminster. And once they hear the jail stuff, they're on the edge of their seats. And even in the rough schools, the teachers say, the kids who stay behind at the end of the talk are our hardest to reach students. Now, I spoke at a school in Woking, and the student was so inspired, she went on to do a criminology degree at Winchester University, and her family invited me to the graduation. I've had a few meals out with the family. And like I said, you know, happiness is in the heart and helping people. When I'm on my deathbed, am I going to look back at all of my stock market transactions? No, I'm going to look back at moments like that. And, you know, you congratulated on my success. And, I'm really happy and privileged. I've got so much respect for you that you see it that way. But there's always setbacks and there's always mean people who just come out of the woodwork and try and trip you up. I'm just going to turn my head to read it. And like I said to you earlier, right now, I'm under attack for the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And they're saying, I'm spreading hate. My channel is spreading hate. I'm putting forward conspiracy theories. And all I'm about is love and trying to help people and give other guys a leg up who've just got out of prison, who've got, you know, have got hardly any resources. Jamie Morgan Cain, he found out while he was in prison, he was adopted as a baby and sold to an American family. He was born on the Isle of Man. He didn't have anyone when he came to London. And he's living with a pen pal he made for a brilliant prison charity called Prisoners Abroad. And we took him to the Isle of Man. He went there, you know, it was his first time visiting the island. And he just resonated with the people. We spoke at the prison there. And just to see the joy in his eyes, that is what my channel is about. It's not about hate in the slightest. And these guys right now are trying to get me completely deplatformed off YouTube. And they say they are anti-hate. Well, that is hate. That is hate, what they're doing. That is an extension of totalitarianism.
Yeah, they talk about hate speech, but really what it is it's speech that they hate. That's what it is. I've watched plenty of your shows. There's no hate going on there. It's the exact opposite of that. But you're very inconvenient for them because you're siding with that David Icke and, you know, he's a troublemaker and blah, blah, blah. And you're giving him this platform and everything. Yeah, your talks with David were every bit as good as Brian Rose and London Real and the conversations that they had. I mean, people that are interested in the Icke Rose parts 1, 2, and 3. Well, check out Sean's interviews with David too, because they're just as good, maybe even better, because it's just, you know, you guys have that really intimate setting and you know, David, I'm going to have him on the show later this month, but David's the best interview you can get, because all you have to do is just say, ladies and gentlemen, introducing David Icke. And then an hour later you say, thanks for talking, David. And you're done. Just wind him up. Let him go. My favorite.
Yeah, and you asked if people want to contact me or see my socials. So my YouTube channel, just under my name, Sean Attwood, S-H-A-U-M-A-T-T Wood. Maybe Charlie will be kind enough to include a link to that.
I will.
My books, I've got 12 books out. My life story is a trilogy, Party Time, Hard Time, Prison Time. During this coronavirus lockdown, every week I'm making one of my books free on Amazon Kindle from Monday to Friday. The ebook, you don't need a Kindle to read it. You can just download the Kindle app and read it on any device. So look out for that. And all my socials, they're just under my name as well. If you go to my website, there's a contact box right there if you want to try and get a hold of me. And I do appreciate all the people who've helped the growth of the channel and subscribed.
I'll put all the links in the description as well. He's Sean Attwood. He's the best, man. Check out his stuff, buy his books, support him, and make sure that these digital hate cocksuckers don't get to what they're looking for, which is a world without any sort of alternative perspective on these important events. So, Sean, thanks so much for hanging out. We enjoy your story, and we definitely support your work.
Cheers. Always love speaking to you, Charlie. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.